that kind of attitude of both, you know, kidding about it, but also it's the kind of thing that was very turbulent. I mean, I was 17. I wanted to look like everyone else and, you know, fit into the group and whatever you do as a teenager. And then I wasn't, you know, that in-group person no more. I was odd. And that was really good for me long term and really bad in the moment.
Hey, y'all. I'm Brian Pagan. Welcome to episode 5 of Mindfolk, Human Creativity and Mindful Innovation in a Podcast. In this episode, I'm speaking with Karin Åkerholm. She's an innovation advisor at Linköping University in Sweden, helping startups and businesses become more sustainable. We talk about a lot here, including her career across design and innovation, what sustainable innovation means in the real world, being comfortable with discomfort, and even what it feels like to survive COVID-19. Enjoy.
Actually, I went through that this spring. I had it.
What do you mean? You had corona?
Yes, but I wasn't that ill. I think many people aren't really. It's like you hear about the bad cases, but it's the same groups that are badly afflicted even by influenza, you know. So for the rest of us, then it was like, you know, being struck with a bad flu, but not but worse than that. So.
Yeah, well, in that case, I'm even more grateful that you're here.
Yes.
So how's life?
When we met, we were like young professionals, I would say. And, you know, I was a designer and worked as a consultant. And now from there, I continued doing that for quite a few years, actually. But moving on from being basically an interaction designer into going more to design strategist, that kind of work, you know. Mm-hmm. More closer to the business of the clients I was working with. And from there, sort of when that route ended career-wise, it was like me and my husband, we were, you know, at this, you know, roadblock or where you sort of decide where you go next. And then we were sort of, where do you go career-wise? Also in the rest of life, because we lived in Gothenburg and then it was lovely. And we explored that, you know, double income, no kids type of life with like lots of concerts and lots of, you know, all that kind of thing. And then after that, then we went like, perhaps that's not what we want no more. We want stability and, you know, calm and all that, but still we want professional development. So then I found my current job and he found another job that he's not currently in. And we moved, to the east side of Sweden, where I'm at. And I've been working in my current role as an innovation advisor for a huge number of years, I would say, but in academia, it's nothing. You know, I've been working 8 years in that role, but we have professors we work with. They've been in the university for ever. So 8 years is nothing in the current role.
Imagine.
But yeah. And I've not been doing, I mean, that's true for any bigger organization, is that the tasks kind of differ, even though the role has the same title, is sort of the content of that role will evolve over the years. And also due to internal processes and, you know, what you need and what's happening around in the world around us and so on. So therefore, it's not necessarily that I day to day, I don't do the same things that I did many years ago. But I still work in innovation and help researchers and also sometimes students, you know, go from idea, or in the case of a researcher, research results into something that could be the start of a business.
That sounds amazing.
It's lovely. Yeah.
Was it always like this, or what's actually changed in the last 8 years?
We didn't really explore, for example, these bits with the thinking of sustainability and the actual impacts of the technologies or other types of innovations that we sent out, you know, into the world. Like, how can we make sure that we cause good things? That's much, it's been like a very big, nearly evolution within the field, not only in innovation, but also in that kind of role that I have as an innovation advisor. Before, it used to be tech transfer offices was the term. And now, not only is it not only tech, there are other things you can find in universities that could make, you know, a good impact in the world that are not technological advancements, like work practices or other things that we need. But also it's like this notion of understanding what we could do, both in scale, but also thinking of like, how can we provide solutions to the biggest challenges? That's been you know, a development for both research, but also it's a thing that, of course, comes into the field of innovation. I mean, if you're going to innovate and if it's really innovative, it should really be something that targets the biggest problems, you know.
For sure.
Obviously.
It's obvious now. How did that change happen? Or like when and how in the course of those 8 years did that shift?
I think, in design, we talk about this with weak signals and, you know, catching the weak signals that might be hidden to many. And in the beginning of these 8 years, that was the case. It was sort of, it was written briefly or like into things like policy documents here and there, but not as explicitly as this is what should be done, but rather considering, you know, environmental impact is a big thing. These kind of, you know, very fluid formulations that nobody really acts upon. And then also, I mean, we have the more activist part of it. Like, you know, we have Greta, so Greta Thunberg. So, I mean, obviously we have these people who sort of try to make things happen or really have an impact on a younger generation. But then also there's been a lot of shift in, for example, I mean, EU has been driving this with the responsible investment, which is also a part of this change, you know, getting funded for what you do and getting investments to be able to spread your innovation widely. And then if the investors are looking more into solid investments that have, you know, a sustainable and good impact, then people really understand that this is the way to go. So, and that's really, I'm describing the journey here. Now it's sort of dawned upon people that this is the new normal. It's sort of going like, wow, this is the thing now. And for us, having been, you know, nerds in that domain for some years, then then obviously it's not like a strike of lightning. It's more like, yeah, finally, you know.
Right.
but it's good to have you on the team, you know. Love to see you here.
Yeah.
But because it's also, I mean, in my role, I work at the university. So we're funded by a government. So in that case, I mean, we're spending the money that you and I sort of put in as with taxes and so on. So therefore, there's a responsibility. What do we spend those funds on? So should we spend them on things that make the world better or worse? You know, one day I'm talking to somebody who's like in caring sciences and talking about how nurses should work in their role. And then the other day, I recently joined the strength area of AI within our university. So that sort of can seem rather disconnected or fragmented. But on the other hand, it's sort of AI is also getting into healthcare a lot. So therefore, it sort of ties together all these things. I mean, what do you use these forces for, these powerful tools? And when are they really good? And how can we make sure that they really do an improvement of a situation rather than just, you know, add a tool to be used or something like that?
How do y'all assess that improvement?
Business-wise, it's very known and very normal that you verify, is this, you know, interesting to possible clients? Is this something that's delivering value? And it's really the value system that's different. I mean, looking at what other values might you be either improving or worsening with your innovation. So looking at it early on, it can be such things as, you know, determining possible risks and helping the researchers overcome those risks. And also thinking of, for example, it's a good thing that we've had a long tradition of thematic research. So therefore, it sort of connects researchers through a theme. But on the other hand, that's not where all the innovation happens. So there are still domains where people do research on things that is relevant, but might not be easy to apply unless you have a crossover with like people who are working in that domain and actually know what, for example, the job as a nurse is daily. How does that work? Where, how can this actually fit into their everyday work? And that process is, of course, a design process. Although I tend to say that I work as a designer in disguise. I don't really say that I'm a designer or that that's my background, but obviously I have a lot of, you know, skills and tools that I sort of secretly use as a designer.
Guerrilla style, almost undercover.
Exactly. Yes. But it's what we all do. I mean, we gather, I think, through your work life and also through your personal life, you sort of gather these experiences and tools and the way that you can do things. And then that total experience is why I think sometimes when I was younger, I thought that people who were like advanced in their career, that they were just good from the get-go. And you go like, that's a star, you know? So obviously they would be great. But more and more, I think getting older, I still think that it's more that you actually accumulate things. And if you can also use that wisely, not just sort of, you know, have it, but not use it. But if you understand things about what you've learned, then you can actually evolve. And that's the stars are those that keep evolving.
And what do you do to help your students keep evolving?
I can be really annoying in that I come into this and I go like, you know, I'm so curious. I sometimes say my super skill is curiosity, is sort of because it's always you go like, wow, oh, what's that? And that's, I mean, this job feeds that curiosity hugely. You know? So
that's fantastic.
However, it's also getting them to think, I think as a designer as well, having that schooling is this, I think Maria Popova, you know, she has that blog Brain Pickings. She sometime posted the quote that creativity is combinatorial. And I know that somebody others have said that as well, but I sometimes think that that's sort of the skill of a designer is like understanding how to combine things or understanding how to open doors for people who might not have seen that as a skill set or, you know, as a combination with what they have. So therefore, this with going, sitting in a meeting, going like, so this is what you want to do. You know, I know who you should talk to. And then connecting them to somebody else or saying that this type of application should really need somebody who knows this. So should I connect you to some students who know that or whatever? So either it's through contacts, you know, being a relationship builder, or it's saying that, okay, so this can be a risk. You might not have, you know, web competence on your team and you should really have that. So how can we make that happen? Or make a client assess that, is this really relevant for them?
Where did that journey start for you? Like when did sustainability become important for you?
One thing, this could actually be in a way a very long story, but I'm not going to make it long. But I do think it comes back to things like, you know, childhood and things like that. My mom used to be a... when she ended her career, she was a teacher at the high school. But before that, long before that, when I was a kid, she was a teacher of Swedish as a second language. So she had a lot of immigrants that she taught Swedish and that we also got, you know, home to us. And we got treated to a lot of novel foods and all these things. Oh, and I thought it was amazing. Cool. And also that was sort of a very, you know, I don't know. I think my sister sometimes, one time said, and when she came with my mother to her work, she was like, where are your children? Because these were grown-ups, you know, like, where, you're a teacher, where are the children? Right. So this with helping people in that sense and also wanting to make, you know, the world better, that's sort of, I think, ingrained in that story as well, although it's in a completely different role and in a completely different type of work, but still. And also it's this with also understanding that there are different struggles for different people is also something that goes back to like family history. Like my grandmother came here, an immigrant after World War II. So quite obviously she'd been in some of the camps and she had a number on her arm and all that. So therefore understanding that starting anew with that kind of history, even though she was like this very little woman, is like she's one of the strongest people I know. It's like obviously rising from that into a normality, just regular life, is mind blowing. But then, not just personally, but also professionally, I've sort of wanted to do more. I've sort of felt, I said, if curiosity is my superpower, then I would say my sort of lacking quality is dismissed with like, I'm very, you know, I don't wait for things. I really want things to happen now. And I go sort of go, why aren't we doing the fantastic things that innovation could arise to? And then you sort of sew that into anything you do. It's sort of, it's like that, what's it called? When you've had that vision, then you can't really, it's like having a pair of glasses. Then you go like, it's the blue pill or the red pill. And then, you know, going from there, you go like, this could be so much better. We could do so much more. And you get sort of always pushing those like buttons with everyone you meet.
Could you give me an example of that?
For example, at our university and in this region, I would say, it's not just at the university, but also business-wise, we have a lot of, for example, environmental tech companies. We have a lot of things that are good at, you know, reducing energy use or, you know, these kind of things that really make an impact in the environmental, you know, kind of shift that needs to happen in industry and how we live and all these things. But in those cases, it's more, there's no value in me pushing environmental issues on them. They know, they have that. That's sort of core to what they do. However, sometimes having that either, you know, guts or whatever trigger is not sort of present, that when you go like, but what about the social aspect? And how are things made that you use? You know, how do these processes look? What kind of work terms do people have? Do we know these things? And that's, in one way, can be seen as being pushy or, you know, bothering people. On the other hand, for especially for companies nowadays, it's like, these things can arise to be like this really bad thing, you know, for them image-wise, you know. So therefore, not building them into new ventures is really quality assurance, I would say. And then there's the other side. It can also be opportunity creation. I mean, for example, you might not understand the kind of qualities you could be providing to a certain situation. You might overlook how much potential this has if you frame it to fit a certain market where this is a much bigger issue. So yeah, you could go on to selling me to like this tech product or whatever, selling to people like me who have things set, you know, or you could think about, could this make an impact to people who wouldn't buy the general product, which is also, I think that's sometimes a mindfuck of some people. It's like either you're good or you're bad, but no, there's like a scaling of this. So therefore being better is a good thing, and you need to keep track of that competition as well. I mean, is everybody having, you know, good conditions in their production shops and so on? Then again, that's the baseline. So you wouldn't dare to go below that.
Sounds like making sustainable change is about moving the baseline. Mm,
I think it's true. And I don't think that we or I or any of us in our different, you know, roles can do that, but together we can. And that's also something that what sort of, you know, what's the cool thing today and what sort of, you know, shameful or what you wouldn't touch, you know, that kind of things do change the, you know, the way we look at things change over time. And the same goes for some of our behaviors. I mean, for Sweden, as an example, we're rather good at this with like composting and, you know, recycling and things like that. On the other hand, we web shop enormous amount of things. So, I mean, the impact you have on the world as a Swedish citizen is what you put out into other countries, because we have the production over there of many things. We have things shipped over here. And of course, this spring, things got crazy because nobody could shop the way they usually do. Like, oh no, things are not coming from China, you know. So how can we live without technical gadgets that we spontaneously shopped to entertain ourselves? You know, but it's a way of sort of, yeah. But that's the current normal has been, okay, we think about what we do here, but not what we do there, you know. And that's also something that could be changed.
I'm looking forward to the days when people look back at this kind of behavior the way that we look at like yeah, Mad Men.
Exactly. People don't bring out the whiskey in like a 10 in the morning meeting. It's like, not people don't think that. Just... with that example, saying that it's not all black and white. I mean, some things might have been nice, you know. Mm-hmm. And also for some people, it might have been nice. It was really, really nice to have a housewife, I'm sure, for those who did. It's very smooth sailing for us who have careers and kids. It's a bigger, you know, it's a puzzle to be solved.
I think, if you don't mind me trying to synthesize.
I'm very okay with that.
A lot of the things that you're talking about feel to me like... It's a lot about connection. So on one level, it's about connection in the sense that a good designer or someone in your role is about bringing people together who can help each other out, who have complementary skills or who could provide value to each other.
Yeah.
But then there's also the connection between like the different thematic industries that your university works with, like the care and AI. But there's also the connections between our decisions and the consequences that they have for maybe other people, but also even on a different level, it's so many levels here that like the connection between our behavior, our policies, and the let's say the people that we choose to be in power, and how this affects, let's say, human migration patterns and refugees and all this kind of thing.
No, but it's true. It's very much both connecting these different, like you're saying, both like levels and industries and so on. But it's also still being able to act upon that knowledge, because it's sometimes you can get really overwhelmed with going like, shit, can we do anything? You know, like, is there any safe space for this? Can we actually act? Or is it just like, you know, overwhelming? And especially, I mean, talking about, for example, the environmental issues and climate change, of course, we can all feel that you go like, there's nothing I can do, you know. And that goes for me as a person, or for us as a family, or for us as an organization and so on. I mean, do the biggest thing, you know, do the biggest change, or make sure that you focus on the issues that are, you know, really critical, rather than going like, we should be perfect and we should do everything. Well, understand where you spend your money and your time and you know, these kind of things. And that goes for, like I said, it's on all levels. And one thing from us is like, we had this, I remember we discussed this, that I've run this project, Liu Changemakers, now for 2 years. And it's a collaboration with a human rights organization called Civil Rights Defenders, and then us at the Innovation Office. And this whole project idea is really, we came together at some networking event and started talking, and talking leads to ideas.
Fantastic.
And then we started actually doing a project proposal without having an idea who was going to fund it, or if our respective management was okay with this or whatever. It's sort of, this is guerrilla action, you know. Or, but then our innovation agency in Sweden opened a call that was like, okay, so we could send it here, because this is actually what we've been saying, you know. So, and we got funded. So therefore we got funding for doing this together. And it's really them providing the problems. These are the challenges that our human rights activists around the world are facing. And then having students try to develop concepts on how these things could be solved. Like from our side at the Innovation Office, we've helped the human rights organization get more insight on what's actually the way of developing innovations, and how can you have that happen in a way that can make them, you know, long-term sustainable in terms of economics, for example. How can they be economically viable over time? Because then they might not depend so much on, you know, public funding and so on. And then, not to say it hasn't been challenging. I mean, anything that's not the same is always challenging. But then you have to be a person who is okay with living, or a person or a group that likes living in, you know, not the easiest, you know, situations, or that you sort of go, okay, so we'll get through this. It's sort of a bit, there's a glitch, but we'll manage, you know.
Be comfortable with discomfort.
Exactly. Which might also be something that I've been become because of life, you know. I lost my hair when I was 17. So starting with comfortable in discomfort, then yeah, that's a good school.
Would you mind saying a little bit more about that? I'm curious.
Losing my hair?
Yes.
Well, it's called alopecia. It's a rather common disease. And I guess the less common is that I don't wear a wig. I never did. But it proved to be a hassle almost immediately. I actually got a wig, but then it's like wearing a knitted cap all the time. It's like incredibly warm. And also you're always like hesitant. It's like, is it sort of crooked? You know, is it not looking right?
Oh, my goodness.
So therefore, instead now it's sort of face, you know, head on. If I move into a room, people go like, and then they go like, okay. So it's just that second of what? And then,
yeah,
it's over.
So I like how you said facing it head on.
Yeah, exactly. Have to be catchy.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, it nice. Really is that. It is. And perhaps I've also gotten that kind of attitude of both, you know, kidding about it, but also it's the kind of thing that was very turbulent. I mean, I was 17. I wanted to look like everyone else and, you know, fit into the group and whatever you do as a teenager. And then I wasn't. you know, that in-group person no more. I was odd. And that was really good for me long term and really bad in the moment.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's very much connected to stress. And I was in the phase of getting straight A's. So that was, you know, it's a good thing to be ambitious. It's a bad thing to be perfectionist.
What's your self-care routine?
Nowadays, I exercise a lot. I didn't. I'm one of these, you know, I was never active in any sport when I was a kid. I'm like, I did some things at school and so on, but I was not the one in the soccer team or whatever. You know, like my friends had all these activities. I didn't do much of that. But I realized that I needed that stress, you know, reliever. So that's really, for me, it's sort of the way I look at being active physically is really because I understand that it burns all that, you know, anger or frustration or whatever. And it also gives you stamina for making, you know, really going for the long haul, daring to do things that you really push your boundaries. That sort of, you can sort of mimic what you do in sports with what you do. So I generally exercise nowadays with COVID. It's been like exercising at home, you know, jogging and whatever. I have kettlebells, I have a TRX, I do everything at home. But also me and my daughter, we go to this, there's like a gym session with kids and grownups. So it's really fun. All the kids laugh at their parents because they look fun doing burpees, you know? Because all of us go like red and going two more, and they are like, yay, you know, like it's not a big thing. So it's also a good way of being humble, you know, realizing that, okay, so it's not like I aced that. It's more like showing her that, okay, so we get through it. It's more grit than elegance in this activity. So
is there, I mean, I just want to express my gratitude for this. It was such a fun and inspiring conversation. I'm really enjoying it. And like, do you have anything that you want to ask or add? Anything else before we wrap up?
I really like this conversation as well. So I'm going to thank you, because I think that ending with letting people think that what could you do more in the role that you have is a good thing. I mean, for me, just changing my own habits or the habits of my family, it's neither innovative or gets into being a big impact for the world. Of course, we should do that also, but it's much more in my role, meeting people that can start something that could be the next big thing, than of course, you know, injecting these values into them and having them understand what they could do could make them much more successful, but also having a greater impact for all of us. So that's really what I could do that could make it even better. So why shouldn't I?
Karen, thank you again for reconnecting after such a long time and sharing your story with us. And folks listening, thank you all for being here with me. I couldn't do this without you. And special thanks to Zubin Nayak for the transcription. May you be safe, healthy, happy, and choose love. Thanks.